Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lover.
Tor Constantino with us. He's the author of A Question of Faith, A Simple Question Towards Ultimate Truth. He's a communications professional with more than 23 years experience as a print broadcast journalist and a Fortune 500 corporate public relations professional. He has participated in thousands of interviews for CBS Radio, Clear Channel, and the BBC, holds an MBA from Rochester Institute of Technology and a bachelor's degree in journalism, and is a member of the American Academy of Religion. Again, his book is A Question of Faith, A Simple Question Towards Ultimate Truth. And let's say, Tor, hi, welcome to the show.
Michael, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Let's start with a definition. And I think in and of itself, this definition is something that is so elusive for most people, they can't seem to get their arms wrapped around it. When we talk about the ultimate truth, we talk about that something. Tor, what in your through your eyes, through all of your studying, your research, the book, what is truth?
Well, you know, there are a lot of books out there that are better equipped than this particular book that I wrote that addresses truth and what ultimate truth is. What I can tell you is what I found out about faith. And faith is not a function of reckless abandon, of following mindlessly after a random cause. Rather, faith is the consideration of options in the face of incomplete information toward a decision of belief. And one truth that I do know is that every faith tradition out there, every society out there on the planet, has a belief system that extends beyond the natural world. And faith is core to the human experience in getting the most out of life. And my hope is that this book will spur individuals to consider the benefits of faith and religion in a positive, relevant light, at the very least, prompt a discussion and desire to seek more information about religions in general.
Now, is there a difference between faith and religion? You know, there are people who say they're very spiritual, they believe in God, without a definition, Tor. And sometimes we get confused between religion and faith. And there are times when religion in and of itself can drive people, can control. You see what happens in the Middle East, you know, in the name of religion and so on and so forth. So how do we distinguish between what true religion is and something that somebody's got a hold of and uses as a tool?
Michael, I think that's a great question. And the simple fact is that people rarely give a great deal of thought about their personal religious beliefs. You've asked about the difference between religion and faith. And to be honest, very few people give a lot of thought about their actual religion. They simply adopt the faith system of either their family, their peer group, or what's predominantly practiced within their respective community. That's the reality of the situation. But that produces a fragile faith that isn't really pressure tested, for number one. And the other thing is that it kind of isolates an individual and keeps them from understanding the other aspects of other people's faith or beliefs or religious traditions that are out there. And I think if we all understood some of the basic tenets of, say, Sikhism or Buddhism or Hinduism or Islam or Judaism or Christianity, if we understood, had a basic understanding, a baseline of what each of those faith traditions were and stood for, we'd have a better understanding of what motivated people. And I think that would go a long way towards helping us understand and relate better, even on something as secular as economics, on a global scale. For instance, people from an Eastern tradition tend to take a much longer perspective on life because they believe in reincarnation, whether you're a Hindu or a Buddhist. Where on the Western side here, we typically tend to think of life as one and done. So at least having that perspective can go a long way if you're doing business in those other countries, to take a perspective that they're looking at a long view and not a short-term fix.
Tor, I think it has to do with acceptance. And when I say that, the tremendous problems that we're having in this country right now, i.e. the culture, whatever is happening to the culture, that kids want to be accepted at home. If they're not accepted at home, and if they don't identify with home, they go someplace else to do so. And sometimes it's in those places where there's gangs and so on and so forth. Someone will accept them. They have an identity. And what's going on today, especially today, people are being driven away from religion, the acceptance of religion, the identity that goes along with having some kind of a faith that you tie to. Yes, most people will believe in the faith that their families, you know, follow, and then they go from there. But I think what's going on now, which is really scary, Tor, is the look what's going on in the schools. You know, you can't have Christmas in the schools, and you can't do this, and you can't do that. And if somebody's got a cross up on the wall, then there's problems, and somebody's going to be sued. What kind of a message is that for children?
Yeah, Michael, that is a serious issue, and I think you make a great point. If you look at like a study that was conducted by the Barna Group in 2009. And this is, and you mentioned Christmas and Christianity, so I'll use this particular study. They referenced that 59% of teenagers from Christian families, these are Christian families, when they leave home, they ultimately leave the faith. That is unique to Christianity, and there's a serious problem there. And I think a lot of that has to do to what you're talking about, this isolation of and separation of church and state. For instance, if you go to England or the UK, they, by law, they're required to teach their kids in the schools about these other faith traditions so that they have a basic underlying understanding. But you bring up a great point about acceptance in the home and alienation in the home. Personally, I was raised in a strict conservative Christian home, and even though I had very loving parents, I wasn't allowed to satisfy my curiosity about other beliefs. So here's the problem for me. When I got to college, I was ill-equipped to adequately defend my own faith, let alone address the truth claims of other beliefs, and as a result, I experienced a crisis of faith and drifted away. But I ultimately came back to a realization and understanding and a deeply held faith that I do have. But it does begin in the home, and what my book tries to do is help families pressure test their belief in a safe environment, namely in the home space. I mean, that's where we basically learn our tenets for socialization, we learn basic language skills, coping skills. Religion should be the same thing. We should be able to experiment, quote-unquote, if you would, in the confines and safety of our home and ask those questions and dare I say, even doubt a little bit, but be gently brought back into line with the particular tenets of the faith tradition of a particular family.
Sure. Now, a society, Tor, creates a culture. And I want to go back to when I was in school. Mm-hmm. I probably mentioned this on the air 5 million times if I mentioned it once, because I think it's something that we have to look at. I happen to be Jewish. We mm-hmm. had Christmas trees. We sang yep. Christmas yep. carols in school. We exchanged gifts. We did everything that you did in, quote-unquote, the American way. And my biggest complaint today when I see what they're doing with the schools and et cetera is that they're taking that everything that I believed in as a culture in this country, and they're trying to throw it out the window. And that in and of itself is something that can hurt us. I object when they take the manger and the rest of it out of the schools, because that's what we were brought up with. Do you have to believe in it? No. The idea is if you don't like it, so don't look at it. And if we would have more of that, I think we'd have less problems.
Michael, I couldn't agree with you anymore. I think you're absolutely right. In our race to be politically correct, we have gutted and completely sanitized and whitewashed what made this country great. Lest we forget, this country at one time was a melting pot. Now that's an anathema, and it's almost heresy to say, and now we have to define ourselves as Americans as, I think they call it now, a tossed salad. I mean, I think that's the vernacular that they're using. The idea is saying that you don't want to offend anybody. You don't want to believe anything because it might run counter to somebody else. But this is an interesting point, and I'm glad you brought it up about the Jewish tradition. There's a big push out there right now to try and communicate that all religions lead to the same thing, and they're all equal, and they're all true. But the reality is, and I'm not exactly sure how we got to this point where we say that they're all equally the same, is that they run counter to each other in some key critical points. So if, for instance, monotheism, that is unique to Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. Judaism was the first monotheistic faith on the planet. That runs counter to polytheism of Hinduism or pantheism of Buddhism. That's one key differentiator. Additionally, the idea of reincarnation. That idea of reincarnation is just opposed and rudimentarily not accepted under Judaism, Islam, or Christianity, but it's a deeply held belief of Sikhism, Hinduism, and Buddhism. So these, the divinity of Jesus. Virtually every world religion rejects his divinity other than Christianity. So the thing is, at each of these points, those differences, I think one of the things that they're trying to do, they, meaning the culture, the society that you talked about, is to try to go along, to get along and say, like, hey, we can all just, you know, wash over those differences and we'll just ignore those parts. But it's those differences that make us unique and really make us, I think, to your point, stronger.
Yeah, when it really comes down to it, I listen, I watch every day. I've got, you know, I usually have news on behind me. I've got to stay abreast of what's going on. But I'm seeing a change. If it was everybody said, let's be sensitive to the other person's religion or their ethnicity or their gender or something, that would be okay. But it doesn't work that way. It's called, let's be sensitive to the ones that are going to make the biggest, you know, the biggest noise about it. So there is a balance, that a homeostasis, the balance somehow that we ended up losing over a period of time. How we can get it back, I have no idea. But I think they're confusing the word religion and the word faith to something that it is morphed into today that it wasn't at one time. You look at the Catholic religion. They're starting to lose people left and right. And let me tell you, the one thing that I thought was great about the Catholic religion years ago, I had a friend of mine who got a doctorate in theology, and he went to the Romance countries, Spain, Portugal, those areas. And the one thing that he came back with was this. When he went to the mental institutions, the beds in the mental institutions were less filled than they were in the rest of Europe. And why was that? Because of Catholicism, because of their ability to go in and confess. They got it off their chest. Those other people didn't have the ability to go in and talk to somebody and get rid of it. So there are those things that are intrinsic within the religions that are very powerful and that most people just take for granted.
Michael, you bring up a great point, and I have a companion workbook that I give away for free, and one of the points of it, it says, why bother with religion? Dr. Michael McAuliffe, he's out of the University of Miami, he has done several studies talking about the connection between religion and health, and you brought up the instance of mental health and religion, and he's got several studies out there and with some interesting stats. Let me just blow through a couple of them. He found that religious affiliation helps people quit smoking. Church attendance was more effective than Alcoholic Anonymous in a study that he published in the Journal of Drug Issues. In a study paper published in 2000, McAuliffe analyzed 42 studies doing a meta-analysis covering more than 125,000 people. Religious followers were nearly 30% more likely to live longer than non-religious study participants. So exactly to your point, there is a benefit to belief. There's a benefit to religion, to the discipline of having a faith. And I think you're right. In this country, we're losing it. There's a statistic that the United States is the second largest missional country in the world. This used to be the seat of missionary activity going abroad, but now we've become so fat and complacent and just wallowing in our wealth and the abundance that we have as a culture and as a country, that we don't think we need God anymore. I would say that we need God more than ever now.
Now, by the way, you mentioned, we're starting to run short of time, but you mentioned Alcoholics Anonymous. What is the base belief that they have, that there is a higher power, and they give themselves up to that? So, in essence, I think the underlying factor for all religions and faiths, etc., are that there is something more than we are, something above us, whatever the case may be. And I think the word atheist is pretty much of an oxymoron, because if you ask an atheist what you believe in, they say they believe in themselves. Well, if you're an atheist, you don't believe in anything. So where do you go with that one? Anyways,
exactly.
Tor, we're just about out of time. Now, do you have a website we can find you at?
Absolutely. I blog daily at www.thedailyretort.com. If people are interested in the book, they can visit www.qfaith.com. That's the letter Q, faith. .com, and they can also find out how to download my free companion workbook, 35-page workbook as well.
Wonderful. By the way, Tor, can we buy the book on the website?
Absolutely. The website that I gave of QFaith.com, that's where you can buy the book.
Wonderful. Hey, Tor, thank you so much for being with us tonight. I've appreciated your time.
Michael, thank you so much. This was delightful.
Take care. Good night.
Take care. Good night.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see.
such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Valerie Frankel with us. She's the author of It's Hard Not to Hate You, a memoir of toxic emotions. She's the author of several novels, including A Sure Thing with Nicole Snooki Pelosi, and such chicklet favorites as The Accidental Virgin, The Girlfriend Curse, and Hex and the Single Girl, a former articles writer at Mademoiselle. She has contributed to the New York Times, O, Glamour, Allure, Self, Good Housekeeping, and many other publications. Her website, I want to make sure we get this a couple of times during the show, is www.ValerieFrankel, F-A-R-A-N-K-E-L, .com. Hey, Valerie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thanks for being here. I love it. It's hard not to hate you. I wonder how many people look in the mirror and say that.
Oh, I think people say it all the time. Just do they admit to saying it? That's the question.
Not to anybody else. But what stimulated that? What was that thought that created you to put this to pen?
Well, the whole book started when I was at the intersection of a health and a career crisis at the same time. I got a scary diagnosis, and this was right at the peak of the Great Recession, and you know when it all really started to hit the fan. And I had this poker face that I pretty much maintained since adolescence of, you know, being appearing unflappable, appearing easygoing, and this double whammy crisis just started to crack the poker face, and all this hate and anger just started to like leak out.
Yeah.
And in a meeting with my doctor after I'd gotten this cancer diagnosis, he said that he recommended that I, you know, as we moved along the process of, you know, having, you know, all the treatments and stuff, that I figure out some way to release stress. And I realized that one of the biggest sources of stress in my life was just trying to maintain that positive attitude all the time. And I said, you know, the hate in me just has to come out. And so I decided to write about it.
You know, there's that time in our lives when we get really stressed, really challenged, and then, it's hard not to hate you. All of the things you bottle up inside to put that mask over you that you don't want anybody to see, which normally what I found out after all these years of being on this planet, they see anyway, and what you think you're hiding is what they use to maneuver you with. But that's it. When you get those challenges and then when you're up against the wall and it all starts to come out. Now, one of two things can happen. You can either let yourself fall apart or you can realize that probably cancer was the best thing that ever happened to you.
I definitely don't agree with that, for sure. But I do think that it took me to a higher level of thinking and consciousness. I totally agree with that.
Same thing. Valerie, we both...
I don't know if I would say it's the same thing.
There's no right or wrong with me, but hear this out. It took you to a new level of consciousness, a new way to think. Would we be sitting here with this book in my hands had you not had cancer?
Huh, that is a good question. Probably not. Yeah. Probably not, because I really didn't even think of trying to a new way of thinking and of letting myself feel sort of in the moment and experience emotions, you know, in real time, as opposed to going numb and then experiencing it in hindsight, which is, I think, my old process. So you're right.
Yeah, and it's not even trying to be right, but when you think about it, if you the book is a legacy. If you touch a life with what you've written, then they can go back and say thank you for what happened to you to cause you to think and be the way you are and put what you put to pen and took the action.
Yeah, you're right. And I hope that this book will affect other people. I really feel happier and more grounded in my life now, having been through this mission of emotional authenticity, to feel whatever appropriate anger I might feel, or to feel appropriate, you know, jealousies and envies, and to really go there, you know, go to the places that I was afraid to go because I didn't want to come off badly, or I didn't want to seem petty, or I just had sort of female-related guilt to being negative at all.
Yeah. And by the way, guilt's a very interesting word. If we define it, if you define guilt, it's thinking thoughts you didn't think you had the right to think. And I think that's, in essence, is what guilt is. You didn't think that you had the right to be that. And that comes from so many other people telling us how to live and how to be.
Oh, it's so true. And I really think the zeitgeist of late, you know, with the positivity movement and The Secret and the Happiness Project and all these messages that it's not just that you should feel happy, it's that if you don't feel happy all the time, horrible things will happen to you.
And by the way,
that's the message that's going out there.
Yeah, but I think, Valerie, I think we call it, you know, when you really come down to it, one of the biggest messages I got out of the Secret was this. I guess the guts of The Secret was that you call to you what you want. And if you look at all the people who are hateful, who are angry, who are depressed, who are this, who are that, hey, they called it and they're getting it. And I believe that if it's just a simple bit of a mind shift, those very things that are happening to you, you can transition, you can change to what you want. But it really comes down to, if you want it, you're going to get it.
Well, I guess then what I set out to achieve with writing this book and going through this really rocky year was to find a new authenticity in my own heart.
Yeah.
And that's what I got. You know, I certainly wasn't trying to manifest a new car or anything like that, which I think is just plain silly.
Well, by the way, you got a better gift than a car.
Well, I did actually get a new car last year, but that's because the old car totally died right in the middle of my block.
Ah, okay, but you got a better gift than a car. I guess what you got was you.
Yes, I did. And I really do feel, you know what, one of my sources in the book was the psychic Mary T. Brown. And she's an old friend from when I reported on that kind of thing when I worked at Mademoiselle. But I interviewed her, and she gave me such incredible advice. She said, you have to close the gap, the authentic emotion gap, between who you think you are and who you think you should be versus who you actually are. And I think there was a pretty wide gap when I began this project that I slowly was able to close. Now, I probably, you know, I just, and when you close that gap, you do lose a lot of the guilt. Because when you just are who you are, as opposed to longing to be who you think you should be, you lose a lot of the hesitation and a lot of the, the guilt of not being whoever you think you should be.
I remember a guy telling me a story once, which is kind of interesting. He was sitting with his therapist, And the guy was really having this tough time. And the therapist said, what's the matter? He says, well, I don't deserve this and that. And the therapist looked at him and he said, well, you know what? I'm going to give you permission. It's okay for you to feel good. And he said, well, who are you to tell me that? And he said, I'm your therapist. And the guy went, oh. And you know that it turned around. All he needed was permission to feel good. And I think that's what most of us need. If you can't give it to yourself, find it through something or let somebody give you permission and say it's okay to be you. And I think that in and of itself has got to be the problem that affects 90% of the people on this planet.
Well, and I think that one of the big points of it's hard not to hate you is that you also had to give yourself permission to feel mad.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people think, I can't be angry. That's wrong. I shouldn't feel, you know, any kind of negative emotion because, you know, for women, there's a lot in the upbringing, you know, the sugar and spice and everything nice thing.
Yeah.
And how we should be forgiving and supportive and nurturing. And I know that I experienced some guilt if I wasn't feeling that all the time.
I used to think that
mother should be eternally patient and you should be a loving wife. And, you know, I personally would get really angry at my husband or really impatient with my kids. And then the guilt on top of it for feeling the negative emotions at all. If you just give yourself permission to, yeah, it's okay to feel impatient. It's okay to be pissed off at your husband if he, you know, goes to the bar for 2 hours.
Yeah.
And that really alleviates a lot of the stress.
By the way, I was like that until I met Barney. Now, Barney has made a tremendous impact in my life. Barney is Barney the beat-up bag. You know those heavy bags the boxers have?
Yeah.
That's Barney. Barney the beat-up bag. And I got one down in my workout area. And every time they get really frustrated and mad, I go take it out on Barney. And Barney was made to get hit, so he enjoys every time he gets smacked. And I get to get mad. I get to get frustrated. I get to hate everybody. And by the time I'm done, I sweat. It's over. I go back upstairs. I'm happy.
That's great.
But it's okay. I think what people need is just that outlet. And everybody should have their own Barney.
It's true. I work out at the gym, and that sometimes causes a lot of stress because I tell the story in the book about a woman who, you know, all the machines were taken, and there was a line to get on the next one, and this woman had draped her coat and her towel on the machine to her right, and everyone online was like, is she using it? What's going on? Is it broken? What's going on? And I think the old me would have been, you know, just stood there livid, you know, furious and just feeling that building of rage, you know, of somebody else's rudeness, which is epidemic in our society. But instead, I said, okay, don't take it personally. She's not doing this to me. And just take some kind of proactive steps to figure out what's going on. So I just went up on the machine and I said, are you using it? And she said, no. And I said, well, I'm going to use it then. Do you mind moving your stuff, or I'll move your stuff for you? And it really was taking a positive action in response to that, you know, building of a negative emotion. And that's really the best, I think, that most people can do with that, you know, that especially impatience. That's a real, real problem for a lot of people, especially in the city.
Valerie, I remember an interview years back, and they were talking about mental toughness. And I have my own definition of mental toughness. And it takes a while to get to this point, but when you can get to this point, you know you've arrived. It's like somebody walks up and says, you're a butthead, and you know what your response is? You bet I am, and I'm good at it.
owning.
Yes.
I have that Oprah concept of,
yeah,
you know.
It's diffusing. I don't have to prove anything to anybody.
I think another big lesson of... You go ahead.
No, okay. I was just saying, it's when you get to the point, you don't have to prove anything to anybody. That's when I think you really start to arrive.
I think you're right. My father said it toward the end of the book when we were just discussing it all. He said that for him, getting older and feeling less pressure for, you know, the kind of success that I was pining for, or the kind of friendships or anything really that you longed for, when you got a bit older, you kind of stopped worrying about all those things. You said the war is over, which really resonated with me. I want to get to that point. I'm still hungry for the things that I want, but I'm not going to let the longing define me. I'm just going to, you know, get through my day and feel good about whatever I accomplished in that day, which includes handling my emotional life as it happens.
Absolutely. And I really think that's the key word, handling it. It's going to happen. I mean, you know, you're human, I'm human, we're all human. It's called, how do you deal with it? And the only time that we let it get out of hand is because of what we think somebody else is doing or the power that we think that they have over us. And the list goes on and on and on and on. It's just called, I think life is like this. You go into the doctor's office and you have your arm up like you're making a bicep muscle, you know, you're showing a bicep muscle off, and you put your arm up like that and you flex your muscle and you say, "Doctor, it hurts when I do that." And the doctor looks at you and said, "Well, then don't do that." And it won't hurt.
Exactly. Another big thing I concluded with in the book was not to take anything personally, because anything that somebody does to you is really just their thing, their problem. That I can only really control what I say and what I do, and that how somebody else reacts to me really has nothing to do with me. It's really, you know, their set of emotional things, their, you know, history that makes them react in a certain way. And I can't control that. I can't really affect it. So, and to just not take, you know, somebody rude or a snobby neighbor or a friend who blows you off, just, you can't take any of it personally.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and I totally agree. Now, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Website, again, that we can find you at and get the book.
Yes, it's www.valeriefrankel.com. The book is available at any bookstore and on Amazon, of course. And my website, ValerieFrankel.com, has sample chapters and lots of reviews and links. So that's really a good place to start.
Wonderful. Hey, Valerie, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. Have a good
Take
night.
Good night.
I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
So I don't have to dream alone.
Ann Garcia McCullough with us and Maria Ellis Yulee with us. They are the authors of Hopeology. Now, in 2006, Ann Garcia McCullough was legally blind and partially paralyzed. Her health improved when she met Maura Yoli. Maura, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And after beginning gentle yoga, receiving energy work, and changing the way she thought, her body began to heal. Dramatic changes showed up within the first year, and she was completely recovered. Her health, her eyesight is now and is recovered, and she's training for her black belt in Muay Thai boxing, kickboxing, and they are both the creators of Hopeology, the seminars, the workshops, the CDs, which help others transform hope to health with humor. And ladies, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Hey, Amara, did I pronounce your last name right?
It's actually Yule.
Yule. Can I start the whole thing over again?
Not necessary.
Okay. All right. I'll never mispronounce it again. I've got it. Where did the story start, and what happened to you?
Well, it started after my son was born. I started noticing I was having a slowing in my left hand, and I was extremely fatigued. And I thought maybe I was just tired from having a newborn child, but as time went on, by the spring of 2004, I started having some very severe eyesight problems to the point where, you know, I was blacking out and losing vision. You know, I had to pull off to the side of the road with my two small kids in the car and have someone come pick me up and drive me home. I just couldn't see well enough. So I went into the eye doctor, at which point he told me, you have one of three things, Anne. You either have MS, you have multiple macular degeneration, or you have glaucoma. And, of course, being kind of a smart aleck like I am, I said, is this a multiple-choice test? Yeah. Is there, you know, an option D for none of the above? And he looked at me and said, no. It's probably something serious. We can't correct it with glasses. At which time I did some more testing, even went to Mayo and Rochester, Minnesota, and was diagnosed with optic neuritis, which is a nerve disease of the eye, and also some symptoms from multiple sclerosis, diagnosed with possible MS.
Okay, now, did anybody ever get the right diagnosis? And I'll get into how quote-unquote we fixed it here, but did any of the allopathic medical doctors really ever get a handle on what it was that was wrong with you?
Yes, and, you know, some felt they did, some felt they didn't. I mean, it was really interesting as I was going through this whole process. I'd go into one doctor, you definitely have this. I went to another doctor, you don't have this. But you know what, the thing that really changed for me is one doctor, a neuro-ophthalmologist, never knew there was such a thing as a neuro-ophthalmologist, but apparently there is. Mm-hmm. And she said, I think you can. And that was a change for me. Somebody finally said, I think you can, because by that point, basically I was told, you know, there's really nothing you can do. This is as good as you're going to get. You know, legally blind, unable to walk, unable to speak more than two words at a time.
Yeah, just out of curiosity, before we take it a step farther, What was going on in your life at the time? When I say what was going on, was the marriage good? Was there problems with something? Was there something that you wanted that you couldn't have, and maybe marriage stopped you from having it? Was there any of those kind of things? We don't have to get personal, but were there any of those kind of things going on?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, at the time I felt like my life was pretty good. But, you know, when we started going through this whole process, there were some traumas and things I needed to release. And the way I was living my life really wasn't working for me. And I didn't have the self-esteem I really have now.
Yeah.
I mean, I was lacking a lot of things.
Sure. And there goes your blindness. I don't mean physically blind.
Yeah.
I don't, symbolic blindness. There goes the blindness, the inability the inability to see. I don't want to see it. I can't talk about it. And if you really think about it, all of those symptoms blocked everything that caused your inability to express. Okay. Now let's take it to Maura. Now, how did you two meet?
She became my neighbor. She moved in four houses down the block. So we met that first day, and I teach yoga. So I I knew that the woman moving in had MS. She had two little kids, and, you know, it was a sad situation. So I offered to show her how to do this practice that's specifically for multiple sclerosis. So I copied it for her, and I had the intention of just, you know, showing it to her and helping her with her body, just trying to get back in touch with her body. And that moved on to, one time when she was bending over in one of the postures, she came back up
And her head was just in so much pain. She felt like she had knives stabbing into her head. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I've broken her. This is not a good thing. And so I began to give her Reiki. And within just a minute or two, the pain subsided, which was incredible, because there were times she'd have to go to the hospital and get injections for pain. They'd be so bad.
Okay, so going through the processes with her, when were some of the first indications that she was turning? Her health?
I think one of the major ones was when we both discovered what surrender could do. And she was beginning to have an attack. You know, it's a beautiful thing. She was beginning to have an attack, and she would get so frustrated and so angry because it could take her out for 3 days or even a week. And so when I just happened to be there, and I didn't know what else to do, so I just held on to her wrists, and we sat down, and we just breathed. She'd been practicing yoga for a while, so she knew how to do some good breath. And within about 10 minutes, everything let go, and the attack never happened.
Yeah,
that
let
was
me give
a
you,
big turning.
Yeah, let me give you a quick story and not use the word surrender, because surrender is very scary for people. But it's the years and years ago, I had this debilitating problem, and I had to get an operation. So I'm on my stationary bike, and I'm working out because I figure that if I do everything I can do to get in good physical shape, then the operation's going to go easier because it's going to be very major for me. And I'm sitting on the bike one day, and I'm pedaling away, and I'm sweating, and all of a sudden it hit me. I made it okay to die. Didn't say I want to die. But I made it okay to die. I stopped fighting it. The minute I stopped fighting it, what happened was my immune system kicked in, the stress went away, my immune system kicked in, and I really believe to this day that's what I'm sitting here talking to you. So it may not even be surrender, that's really what it is, but it's allowing it. It's stop fighting it.
That's right. We call it coexisting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we call it.
Yeah, okay, now, but the other side of that, too, I'm seeing here in the press release that all of a sudden that Anne's got, she's now got a, she's working, she trained for a black belt in the Muay Thai, the kickboxing. That all of a sudden now, what's in your life that wasn't there before that you're identifying with?
You know, I guess I really found the journey to me.
Yeah.
And finding the space and peace. And even recognizing myself, I think the best way to describe it is I finally looked in the mirror, and for the first time ever, I recognized that person in the mirror. And I love that person. And when I found sort of, you know, that's what Hopeology is sort of all the different steps that I took. You know, I changed my spirit, I changed my mind, and then my body followed. You know, caring for that spirit and the mind. There was such a disconnect happening between my spirit and my body. You know, our human and beingness are... our humanness being our physical self and the beingness being the spiritual self. And I think there was such a disconnect. And now there's a major connect. It's all working together. And the Muay Thai for me is actually very physical and also very spiritual at the same time. So it's feeding me, truly.
But you also have a reason to live, don't you?
Absolutely, I do.
Yeah. And that's where most people get stuck in this. They don't have a reason to live. It just seems that that everything they're doing in life, even though it might look good, is what somebody else wanted them to do. It's not really what they wanted to do. But then it starts to back up, and your body and your emotions are going to show it any way you look at it. That's how it's going to come out.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, it was living in that state of dis-ease or disorder is what we call it. You know, that lack of ease or lack of order. Really
sure.
Comes from exactly what you're talking about, is sort of living an expected life that really isn't who you are is your true self.
Okay, let's talk yoga for a minute. Most people, if you say the word yoga, you got this picture of somebody sitting a foot and a half off the ground, so twisted around that you don't believe their body can go in that way, and this look of peace in their eyes. Now, most people don't feel that that's something that is a reachable goal. They don't think it's manageable, and they don't feel that they can get there. But that's not truly what yoga is. So if I were to ask you, Mauro, what yoga is, what is it practically without what people have this idea that it is?
Yeah, at the beginning of my classes, if I have new students, I give them my disclaimer. And my disclaimer is that yoga is an internal practice. And it never, ever matters what you look like in any of the positions. No one cares. There's no competition. And that really the most important thing is breath. So if you are breathing and you're paying attention to your body, you are practicing yoga.
Okay,
and
by the way,
can do that.
Yeah, and by the way, that's simple, isn't it?
It is. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely. And every body is different, and we have to listen to our bodies, and maybe they improve and maybe they don't, but we just keep working with them.
Okay, now let's take it to the next level, or whatever, wherever this fits in. When you talk about diet, the right way to make your diet healthier, most people use this word diet all over the place, and they don't seem to get it, because underneath it, there's a word called nutrition. So it's not necessarily how much you eat, it's what you eat.
Yeah, absolutely.
How important is this, you know, that for the total look, the total concept, how important is how and what you eat?
It's extremely important. I mean, I think that's really where my turning point was. I mean, I was having all these tools, but what ended up happening is, you know, we're machines. That's why a lot of times diets, as you were mentioning, don't really work. I mean, every body is different. And for me, you know, it started with making very simple changes. And when I did this, I started noticing it. It's sort of like the body's been speaking to me for a long time. It just turned the volume up really loud and started screaming and having all these physical symptoms. But when I started taking, you know, gluten out of my diet and sugar out of my diet and dairy, which is, you know, inflammatory, my body started to change. My ability started to change, and it started working better.
Now, by the way, the word inflammatory is extremely important. Most problems come from what? There's a word I'm looking for, and I don't know what the word is. When your body is inflamed, what's the opposite of that? What happens when your body gets inflamed? What happens when your body gets inflamed? I've lost the word.
It becomes stagnant, I guess, in a way. You're, you know, stiff.
Now,
painful.
4 o'clock in the morning, I'll call you guys when I remember what the word was. But
we're all going to be at home by then.
Yeah. For heart problems and the rest of it, it seems as though when that particular stress on your body is where the problem is. In effect, what we really, when we look at medicine, it's to get rid of that inflammation, because it's in the inflammation that causes the heart problems and the rest of it. And that's what we do. We strive to clean that up.
Right.
Yeah, whatever the word was. Okay, now, then it's close to inflammation. I'll figure out what it was. But I go to a Hopeology seminar. You know, what are the average person that goes there? What kind of people are they?
Well, I would say mostly women. We've had several men in the audiences, and we hear all sorts of benefits from them, as well as from, you know, kind of the same demographic as Anne and me, kind of middle of the road women, a lot of who come. But it's very cool what people take away. Some people come because they are physically ill, and some people come because they're curious or because they're looking for something. And it's very interesting what people go away with. For example, one of the gentlemen who came wound up tripling his business. And then another woman decided that it was time for her to ask her husband to leave. We don't necessarily encourage such behavior, but
yeah, come to class and get rid of the bum. Yeah, I got it.
But
I'm going to go back to what Anne was talking about. We're starting to run out of time, but I'm going to go back to what she was talking about. That, you know, if somebody is not happy, and if they're not aware of what it is, and if it has to be that the person that you're married to is not the right one for you and is triggering all these things, sometimes the best solution in the world is to say goodbye. So it's not saying that you come to class and you're going to get a divorce. But if that's what the case is, that's what the case is. We're running out of time. Let me ask you this. Website we can find you and find out more about Hopeology.
Yeah, the website is
Go ahead, Ann.
Okay, infusionofhope.com. And there you can go. There's a home page, a schedule page for events for us, and there's a purchase page there. And there you can download or buy the CDs for the seminar.
Wonderful. Hey, the two of you, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
It was great.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
You'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging. You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you're got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you won't get. You know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so quick. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days. Miss my hugging, you're gonna miss my kissing, you may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, for you.
Welcome back on Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. David Bennett with us, co-author of Voyage of Purpose, Spiritual Wisdom from Near Death Back to Life. He's a spiritual activist who invokes empowerment with grounded and practical spirituality. He's a champion of the soul and a catalyst for transformation. David is the author of Voyage of Purpose. He's a public speaker. He's a teacher. He's familiar with both radio and television after many, many appearances, including being filmed for National News and PBS. David is also known to the publishing world for his articles in numerous magazines, blogs, and papers. And David, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael Ray. It's great to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here, David. You know, when people hear about near-death experiences, or if someone's actually died, for the average person, it is so frightening to them that they basically can't fathom what that is. So let's take you back to the very first time when something happened to you. Where was it? What actually happened to you? And, David, more important, what did you experience?
Yes, back in 1983, I was the chief engineer of the research vessel Aloha. And we had an accident where we were in a small boat, one of the rubber Zodiacs, and we were 2 miles off the California coast, and we slid off a 25-foot swell. And the next one came, and it was a breaker, and it broke our little boat right in half. It folded in half just like a peanut butter sandwich. Mm. I was catapulted into the water, and I'm a commercial diver. I'm trained to be in the water. I'm used to it. So I didn't panic or anything like that. But you can only hold your breath so long. And I ended up drowning. And so I immediately found myself in this absolute darkness. It was but it felt like a living type of darkness. And I was very curious because in diver training, they teach us, we actually simulate oxygen deprivation in our training. So this was something way beyond that. And I just died a very violent death in this raging sea. But I found myself very curious. And then I saw the light. We've all heard about the light and from near-death sure. experiences. But I didn't experience a tunnel. I just saw the light off in the distance, and it felt like I was moving toward it. And as I got closer, 12 light beings emerged from the light and greeted me. And as I got closer, it felt like I was being wrapped in love. And to this day, I still get a little choked up just remembering it. And the 12 of them welcomed me home. It was like something I'd never, ever experienced. It was from something other than this world. And we actually reviewed my life. We went through a life review where I experienced every interaction I'd had in my life, and I not only experienced it from my point of view, but I also experienced it from everyone else's point of view. So, and not only was I experiencing it, but my soul family, these 12 light beings, were experiencing it with me. And I got to see the good and the bad. I was the chief engineer of this research vessel at the age of 27, and, you know, at that young age, to get that position, I had to step on a few toes. And so I saw some things I didn't care for, and I felt ashamed that these beings had to experience this, but they didn't. They didn't judge me. They just supported me and loved me through it. And eventually, I reached a certain point where I was seeing my future. I didn't know it at the time, but this family supported me even more, and they got me through what I was seeing. And then the light itself spoke to me and told me, "This is not your time. You must return." Well, I argued with it. I argued with God because I was feeling loved and supported like I'd never felt before in my life, and I didn't want to go back. I knew that my body was pretty broken, and it wasn't attractive to me at all. I felt so expansive in this light. Also, when you're in this light, you feel like your consciousness is connected to something greater than yourself, and so I pleaded. I said, "No, I'm not going back." And the light spoke to me one more time, and it said, "No, you must return. You have a purpose." And that's when I found myself back outside my body. When I heard that word purpose, I understood it and I accepted it.
Did those light beings, the soul family, did they come back with you? And when I say did they come back with you, if they touched you, they had to become involved with you emotionally and spiritually. So are they still here?
Yes, they're with me every day. And they actually helped me get back in my body because I didn't quite understand how this, because I had a light body of my own, and I didn't understand how the enormity of my true being was going to fit in that physical little body, you know.
Now, I remember going back some years, a lot more than some years, and I remember doing interviews about when people die. And they have found, and they've done it occasionally, that when somebody dies, if they're in a hospital bed, etc., there are people who have been weighed, and there was a difference between the weight before they died and after they died, and people who have been there during that death experience have actually time and again seen something leave that body. So there is an essence in us that is more than just what they call life today. And I can't fathom in my heart of hearts, David, that when you die, it's over with. It can't be, because that whatever that something is within you seems to go beyond the body.
I totally agree with you, Michael Ray. I believe that our consciousness lives on in a pure form that's much more expansive, and we're liberated from these physical confines that we experience here.
Now, by the way, the near-death experience for you, what did you learn? What was that one, that quote-unquote aha moment, that blind spot that was always in your life and is in most people's life? What was the big lesson there? What was it that you got that you didn't have before?
I'd have to say there were two things. One is that when we die, we don't die. And the other thing is that we're loved. We're loved so much all the time. And I was totally unaware of that. I'd had a pretty dysfunctional life leading up to that. And my philosophy in life prior to my experience was to just cut your swath through life and survive. That was, and that's a pretty brutal philosophy when you break it down. But the love that I felt and knowing that I'm loved, that was transformational for me.
Yeah. Now, by the way, years later, you got diagnosed with, stage 4 cancer in your lungs, in your bones. Now, by the way, stage 4, from what I understand, stop me if I'm wrong, that's when they say, go home, pack your stuff, write your will, it's over.
Yes, in fact, I had lung cancer that had metastasized into my spine. It ate away 2.5 bones in my thoracic spine, and the tumor couldn't support my spine any longer. My spine had collapsed. After they started testing and checking me, they found I had lesions in my hip, my brains, my kidneys. They told me I only had weeks to survive, and they were going to make me comfortable with stage 4 lung and bone, you know, with this stage 4 cancer, and they were going to just let me expire. But I had seen part of my future in that near-death experience back in 83, and now it's 2000. It was November 2000 when my spine collapsed. And I knew I was going to have this cancer at some point in my life. I didn't think it was going to happen that soon. I thought it was going to happen much later in life. But I also saw in my life review that I was going to live beyond it. So I told the doctors, no, we're going to treat this, and I'm going to get past it. Of course, they didn't believe me. They thought I was in denial. You know, the first step of prognosis like that is denial. But I felt I'd gone right to acceptance. I accepted the diagnosis right away, and I knew that it was a part of my purpose.
And I guess when it really comes down to it, that what you're dealing with is, and I just got into this in the interview just before we were on, it's about stop resisting things. I don't mean you, but just in the general sense of the term. You resist things. You resist death. You resist the bad relationship. You resist a debilitating disease. It's called, that doesn't mean give up. It's called stop resisting it, because in everything in life, David, there is something beyond that. There's something that it's forcing you to take a look at, but you weren't looking at before, that you have to know. And if you keep resisting it, it's going to keep banging you on the head until you take a look. And if you don't look, you're going to leave with it.
Exactly. Well, with the cancer, I accepted it immediately. I knew that this was something I had to go through, but I also knew without a doubt I was going to live beyond it. Three tools that I live by quite a bit is acceptance, tolerance, and truth. I accept who I am. I know I might have issues and problems, that sort of thing. Also, tolerance. You know, life throws a lot of stuff at us. And tolerance, I have a tolerance knowing that I can get beyond any obstacle that life throws at me or people that cross my path. I may not always agree with everyone who comes across my path, and that's fine. I can be tolerant of that. And also truth. I can understand that we all can share an experience, but each and every one of us will come out with a different truth, a truth, and this type of truth, I feel we weigh this in our heart more than our mind.
No question about it. And most people are frightened to death to live. They're frightened of what's going to happen next, and they resist, and they hide, and they put on masks and facades. And what's that old adage? Is something like, you know, better unhappy than unsure. And most people live their life like that. And if they just stop it, you know, the guys like you who went the distance, quote unquote, and you came back, but you came back with a whole lot more than you left with.
Yeah, but there's some challenges that come with that, because our society is not really geared up to support someone who's had a spiritually transformative experience. I have a couple support groups up here that I run for experiencers, not just near-death experience, but anybody who's had any form of spiritually transformative experience. And the challenges that people face are I don't think people understand it. And I think that's what the message in my book is more about, is that there's a process that experiencers have to go through in order to get to this point where I am now. I feel like I've fairly integrated my experience and that I'm living by what I learned in my experience. But many experiencers have to go through a series of challenges but to get to that point.
Yeah, but and I really think the biggest challenge, and I would say this to everybody out there, the absolute biggest challenge and the most painful challenge you have is go look in the mirror.
Yeah, know yourself. Yes.
Yeah, I mean that's really with it. It's not anybody else. It's not what you can have, you can't have, or what somebody else thinks. It's what you do with everything that you've got. And the only reason people aren't ready for what you're talking about, for the most part, they're afraid of it. And that's okay. I mean, it's going to happen.
Yeah, people are afraid of death. Our culture has kind of taught us to fear death when we really don't need to. I no longer fear death. In fact, I long to return home, but I also understand how sacred it is to live this life. And before you were talking about how life, has a lot of twists and turns, and I enjoy the twists and turns. You know, I like to allow life to unfold.
No, absolutely. What that you just said it. Let it unfold and work with what you've got. And I think that's realistically what it's about. If more people would just sit down and get in the now for a moment, we rush 10 minutes ahead and 20 minutes behind, and you get to a point where you never get anywhere. Who was it? Here it is. I kept this. Riz Mirza was he's a psychic, and he was on the show, I don't know, months ago. And there was something in his press release that I took out and I cut off and I put up here. And it says, people always ask me what happens after you die. And I ask them what happens when you finally live.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think dying helped me learn how to live. It really did in the long run. Because I do, I enjoy my life and I try to live a very mindful life and also what I call my quiet ministry. It's something that I've learned that I need. That life review was incredibly transformative for me as well, and so I try to live by what I learned. All those interactions and all those ripples, I feel whenever I interact with another person, I try to be totally present for that person. Just be there for that person and keep my focus and my mindfulness in that moment with people and try to do it as heart-centered as I can.
You know, and there's one thing that that before we were running out of time, the one thing before we leave, we've done it on the air a few times, but it's so critically important. It's really what mindfulness is all about. You're sitting at a desk?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, touch the desk. You got it?
All right. Yes.
Before you touched the desk, David, the thing did not exist. It wasn't even there, was it?
No.
And I think that's a prime example of what mindfulness is about. Unless you put your attention to it, it doesn't exist. And with that, David Bennett, do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, the book website is voyageofpurpose.com, and then I have a personal website that is Dharma Talks, DharmaTalks, DharmaTalks.com. Also, you can find me on Twitter and Facebook under Dharma Talks. I do a lot of, I put a lot of reflections out there on a daily basis.
Wonderful. We'll chase you down on Twitter.
Okay.
All right. Hey, by the way, David, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Michael Ray. It's been a pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
I'm in love with you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've had a love of my own.
And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I've had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Harvey McKay with us, the author of The McKay MBA of Selling in the Real World. And Harvey is the founder and chairman of the $100 million McKay Mitchell Envelope Company, which he founded at age 26. His nationally syndicated weekly business column for United Features Syndicate runs in 100 newspapers across the country. He's written six new New York Times bestselling books, three number ones, including the blockbuster Swim with Sharks Without Being Eaten Alive and Beware of the Naked Man Who Offers You His Shirt. And let's say, Harvey, hi. Welcome to the show.
Boy, I've been looking forward to this, Michael. Thanks very much. I know it sounds self-serving, but as of 10 minutes ago, I was just informed by my publisher that this is my seventh. The McKay MBA of Selling made the New York Times bestseller list.
Oh,
so
great.
I'm proud of that.
By the way, that's not self-serving, Harvey. That's great.
Well, thank you.
When it really
nice to be with you again.
Oh, hey, and thank you so much for coming back. Let me ask you this. You know, this word so many people get confused over, frightened to death of. The word is called selling. Harvey, there's so many people who do not understand it. So let's define what selling is.
Well, first of all, let me salute and applaud the unsung hero of today's business world, and that is the salesperson. You know, there are no jobs. Okay, there are no factories. There's nothing unless someone brings the business through the front door. So selling is a combination of, obviously, you have to have trust. If I'm going to sell you something, have to have passion, persistence, loyalty, work ethic, self-starter. Nothing has changed from my perception, okay, and my perspective in the last 75 to 100 years in order to be successful at selling something. And remember, every listener out there, we're all salespeople. Why? We are selling ideas. We have a reading, writing, and speaking vocabulary, and, of course, the speaking vocabulary is a must if you're going to be a successful salesperson.
You know, another way to define sales is offer and acceptance, because most people don't get that. You find somebody, you fall in love with her, and you say, will you marry me? You're making her an offer. She's going to accept or reject. And if you've done your homework, she'll say yes.
Well, that's right. It's a legal definition the offer and the acceptance. However, if she happens to say no, there's no substitute for persistence, right? How many persons in this world of 7 billion out there that have said no, either male or female, at the first effort, correct?
Oh,
I know,
absolutely.
I did. I didn't just say, will you marry me the first time around if I turn the clock back. So that's kind of a nice little skill to have also, a little bit of persistence.
Yes, and the compelling reason to buy. You should have said, look, I'm cute. You should say yes to me. Okay, now, what makes a good salesperson? I mean, everybody's got it in them, but there are people who move beyond, Harvey. They have that certain bit of knowledge that allows them to step beyond the crowd.
Well, I like to put it this way. It's my favorite chapter in the book, and I just mentioned all the skills that you have to be successful that hasn't changed in the last 50 to 75 years. Now, having said that, though, you have to fuse, and that's why I wrote the book. There's been a seismic shift out there, Michael, in what's happened in the marketplace. It's not dog-eat-dog or rat-eat-rat out there. It's shark-eat-shark. I mean, it's take the business away from somebody else. So if you fuse the high technology with the skills that you have to be a successful salesperson. You can't beat that. So let me go then to my favorite chapter, which indirectly answers your question, but I think it's a salient point. Practice makes perfect. Not true. You have to add one word. Perfect practice makes perfect. Practice something time and time again. If you don't know what you're doing, what are you doing? You're perfecting an error. You've put a ceiling on how good you can become. There's 20 million golfers out there, all right, out of a population of 310 million. Let's say you play 8 days a week. Let's say you practice 8 days a week, and you have a loop in your swing. What are you doing? You're perfecting an error. Put a ceiling on how good you can become. So if we only had 3 minutes to do this interview, the next 100 seconds is what I believe answers your question and a lot of questions, because people are trying their guts out there, and they're not being successful. Michael, I have a speech coach. I speak once a week for the last 24 years, India, Pakistan, Germany, China, Russia, and I have a speech coach. I run 10 marathons, Boston, New York, Twin Cities. I have a marathon coach. I have a golf coach. I have a skiing coach. I have a humor coach. I've got a skiing coach. Why do I have all these coaches? Because whatever my God-given talent is, whatever my God-given potential is, guess what? I can't get any better. So I make a decision. Okay, I make a decision. I concentrate, time and action calendar, get the advice, okay, which is answering your question, what makes that extra kind of person, get the best help I can, the best coaching I can, and I don't have to worry about anything. That's it. I'm focused, and I try, and I don't worry.
By the way, I am totally on your side of the table with that. Let's throw something else into the mix now that wasn't around 200 years ago when I first got into the marketing and sales business. Google. Harvey, today, I think the biggest challenges that people have today as opposed to what we had years ago was Google. There is a there's a website called where I live, right outside of the Milwaukee area. It's beepbeep.com. You Google any kind of a car you want. It goes to every one of the car dealerships. You can zero in on the car. You can get Carfax or whatever it is and find out everything you ever wanted to know when it was scratched. You make your deal. You negotiate. You do everything but drive the car. You don't even have to go down there. So in essence, I think the real key to selling today is we can't sell anymore. What we have to do is frame it in such a way that the potential buyer buys. And I think that's really what most salespeople are up against today.
Well, everything you say is true, but I want to tell you, we have a 35-person sales force here, and what you say is true, but let's even take it to the next level for all of our listeners. All right, you have to, over and above what you just stated, you have to humanize your selling strategy because of Google and because of the technological explosion. What do I mean by that? And I write a whole chapter on it. It's the invisible web. You're naming deep.com. Well, there's an invisible web out there, and I can find out virtually everything I want. We call on 3,000 buyers in 20 countries and also 85% of our business in the United States, also in your area right there in Milwaukee. All right? Yeah. What does that mean? The invisible web can tell me, Michael, I can find out before I make a call on you whether you're a Democrat, Republican, Independent, if you're a golfer, what your golf scores are, what courses you play, where do you live, who do you make contributions to with your charity. I can find out all that. So if I want to sell you, Michael, all right, and I'm walking in to sell you, widgets, envelopes, doesn't matter, nuts and bolts, insurance, or I want a job, you're an HR, human resource person, I want the job. Before I walk in, if I know you're born in Chicago and you're raised in L.A. and you spent time 23 years in Fairbanks, Alaska, you're a pioneer in talk radio in Alaska, you're a serial entrepreneur, you do a lot of media training, and, you know, we don't have a lot of time during this interview. This is the short list.
Harvey, there's only one thing.
If I know all this before I walk in, Michael, what's the probability I will sell you?
Wait, there's only one thing I have to say at this moment. Do you take credit cards?
All right, so my point is, that's what we teach. That's what the book teaches you. how to go deep. People buy from other people because of likability, because of people skills, without question. You can't talk all the time about business. If I'm coming into you, you're a purchasing manager at a Fortune 500 company or a small company, doesn't matter. Do you think for the 20 minutes we're going to talk business? No, 30% business, 70% social. That's why we humanize our selling strategy. Incidentally, if I may mention this, I just started this a few hours ago, and I'd love to offer it to all your listeners, okay? One of the chapters is deliver more than you promise. So I teach creativity, and I'm just going to have a sidebar here. Every study known to mankind, there's no correlation between IQ and creativity. Every listener out there can become way more creative than they ever dreamed about. So here's what I came up with just a couple hours ago. If anybody's going to buy the McKay MBA, all right, of selling in the real world, then guess what? All they have to do is go to HarveyMackay.com/bonus. Harvey McKay, it's MACKAY.com/bonus. And guess what? No proof of purchase. Just go there. Say you're going to buy the book. You get a $12.95 book on networking, which is just incredible. You can't buy that book anywhere else. If you want to download it, then you can download it. We'll tell you how, or we'll send you the book no charge. So there's 20 pages in that book of my speech at the Harvard MBA program, which I think is the reason why I built my business here. So I'm happy to offer that, and thank you for allowing me a minute to explain it.
Oh, my absolute pleasure, because I think in today's world, more than anything else, Harvey, the people need to know how to sell, know the dynamic of a sale, know that when you walk in, for the minutes you say hi until you say goodbye, everything is intentional and what's said is going to have a predetermined reaction. It's important that that happens today because of all, quote unquote, the competition out there. There is much more competition than there was 15 or 20 years ago because of Google, because of the rest of it. So to know what you're teaching puts you a step ahead of the game where most people have no idea, and they end up at the end of the day with the sales that they didn't get and the income that they didn't get and the disappointed people that hired them.
I couldn't agree more without question. Incidentally, a quick little side PS. If you just turn to the back of the book, you'll find a money-back guarantee there if they don't like the book. When I wrote Swim with the Sharks Without Being Eaten Alive, I had a six-week World War III fight with my publisher. I wanted to be the first author in the country to offer their money back on the back page. I prevailed, finally, after 6 weeks, 5 million copies sold of Swim with the Sharks, still selling a quarter of a million a year 24 years later, okay, in 80 countries and 44 languages. But guess what? 18 people have asked for their money back. 7 of them were my best friends.
That's funny. I mean, it's not been funny, but yeah. Okay, no, and I got it. I got very, 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 very loud and clear. There's another thing that goes on. I want to jump into a few things because I want to make sure we get as much as we can out of the time that
Surely.
We have allotted. There are too many people, Harvey, that get rejected. They don't understand what no means, and they don't understand how to overcome. For the most part, what do you do? What are some of the first steps to do once you got a rejection? Somebody said no.
Well, you nailed it, quite frankly, Michael. There's 70,000 words in the book between those covers, 82 chapters, all the chapters, although a couple pages only. That one key word, rejection, is the most important word probably in the book. And guess what? Rejection doesn't have to be permanent. Failure doesn't have to be permanent. What's the number one fault of all the salespeople out there and why people don't go into sales? Because of rejection, and number one, they take it personally. Number two, they wallow in their defeat. You can't do that. I wrote a book about 8-9 years ago. We got fired, and it's the best thing that ever happened to us. I interviewed 28 famous people. Mayor Bloomberg got fired from Goldman Sachs. Lou Holtz got fired from Arkansas. He happens to be my best friend. We're joined at the hip. My brother, for all intent and purposes. But I interviewed all these people, Jesse the Body Ventura, Yankees coach, on and on and on, Joe Torre. And what did they find out? They found out that they have to learn from their rejection. They have to learn from the failure. You have to analyze your defeat and then pick yourself up. You know, to be down is not a failure or a rejection. To stay down, that is a serious problem. Now, here's what we teach our people, again, my 35 sales person force. Here's what we do. Let's say, again, we're calling on you, Michael. Let's say I'm calling on you. I don't get the business. You award a two-year contract to someone else. I come back 2, 3, 4 weeks later. I look you right in the eye and say, will you help me, Michael? Where did I make my mistake? I'd like to grow. All right. Was I a good listener, poor listener? Did I come on too hard? Did I know enough about my product? I'll answer, you know, any question you ask. I'll ask you questions. I want constant, immediate, unfiltered feedback from my customers, which is you. And guess what? That's how you improve. So those are some of the things. And then lastly, you can't sell everyone. So if you're out there in sales, and remember now, We're all salespeople because we're selling ideas. Lawyers, and believe it or not, accountants, everybody, teachers, everybody's selling ideas. And so if those ideas are rejected, again, you can't sell everyone.
Now, by the way, let me throw some, let's add something to the mix here. Harvey, what I have learned over all these years and years and years and years, and I'm only 17 years old, how's that? That when somebody once asked me one day, and I really had to think about this, and this is the answer they finally came up with, and I've worked everything around this. Most people say, what are you selling? You know, and they're going to say, you know, I'm selling books, I'm selling products, I'm ideas, information, myself, whatever the case may be. And that's not what they're selling. It comes back to that old question. You know, you go to a hardware store to get a drill because you're doing a project, you want a hole in the wall. So the question would be to say, what do you want? Are you buying the drill or are you buying the hole? Most people say they're buying the drill. Information, the ideas, the books, the concepts are all the drill. What they're buying is what that drill can do for them, which happens to be the hole. And what the hole is, people buy one thing and one thing only. In all of my experience, they buy a solution to a problem. And that's it. If you can get what that problem is that they've got, and you tie your solution to it, and they can fix what their problem is and their blind spot is with what you have to offer, most of the time, you're going to have the sale.
You know what I just figured out, Michael? I'm glad you're not in the envelope business. I don't want to be competing with you. that's very, very, very good. And that's through a myriad of strategies and tactics. And it all starts with listening in the beginning. You can't, everything you just talked about, you can't achieve unless you're a great listener. If you're doing the talking, you can't learn anything. Real succinct, very quickly, a story. I'm in Chicago, 500 people. It's a sales conference. It's dessert time. Before the speaker, all of a sudden I hear a shut up. And look around, don't know where it's coming from. 10 seconds later, shut up. A little bit louder. 20 seconds later, a shut up, a lot louder. Fellow gets up, 5'6", so skinny he can tread water in a test tube, and he gets up there. He says, hi, I'm your luncheon speaker. And I just told you the single most important skill in becoming a salesperson, successful salesperson, and I told it to you 3 times.
Absolutely. So, you asked the closing question. Shut up.
Yeah, you must listen. You must be a good listener to get to those solutions and to absolutely have that customer visualize. I talk about visualization, of course. Anyway, it's really a huge thrill when you meet a stranger and you get the order. I want to tell you, I'm still turned on after all these years running my company when I can walk into XYZ company, sell them a product, perform, build the relationship over a long period of time. One other thing that I'll say again indirectly, which is doing what you're saying to a degree, and that is this. I call it reciprocity without keeping score. Now, my father headed the Associated Press 40 years, national syndicated columnist. I followed, of course, in his footsteps as well as becoming an entrepreneur. And again, I always wanted to be an entrepreneur, still have trouble spelling that word, but that's exactly what I wanted to be. So here's what my father taught me. if I meet you, hi, I'm Michael Harvey McKay, I'm Michael Dresser. All right. Right to my brain bank, I say to myself, what can I do for Michael Dresser? Okay? Now, over and above that, he took it a step further when I was 18 years old. It's expect nothing in return. And if you can live your life that way, and that's what I've been doing, and that's what works for me and the people I've mentored, about 500 of them here in Minneapolis where I'm calling from my factory that I started at age 26. If you can live your life that way, what can I do for you and expect nothing in return, trust me, probability for success, probability for happiness goes dramatically up.
Harvey, we're running out of time, but I want to leave it with this. You said something about visualization before. Let them see themselves in and visualize it. Every word you speak, I'll make this fast. Every word you speak has a corresponding mental image. It has a picture that goes to that subconscious mind. So every word you say has, again, a picture. Now, if the word that you say is not recognizable to the person that you're speaking to, it's going to go right over their head. If I say to you, chamber around, do you know what that means? Chamber around. Do you have any idea what that means?
No, of course not.
Okay, all right.
Chamber around?
Yeah, you don't have a mental picture.
No, you're talking Chinese.
Okay, good. All right, now, let me bring it home. But if I say put a bullet in a gun, you have a picture of that, don't you?
I surely do.
Sure. A round is a bullet, and a chamber is where you stick the round. So what I'm saying to you and everybody else out there, in communication, result-oriented communication, they have got to have a mental picture for what you're saying, because if they don't recognize it, it's going to go right over their head. It's the same thing with a concept or an idea. So how do you fix it? You tell a story behind it, and that qualifies it. You hear a news headline. Headline said, man stabbed son. How do you know if it was murder or an emergency tracheotomy? It's the story that follows that leads you to. Yeah, you got it. Anyways, by the way, one more time, please, with your website.
Well, you go to HarveyMcKay.com/bonus if you're going to buy the book. And then, again, you're on your word of honor. We will send you that beautiful, fabulous $12.95 free hard copy, you know, the hard book, too, right to your address wherever you are in the country, no charge. And it's, again, on networking, Harvey McKay, MacKay.com/bonus. If you're going to buy the book, or if you want to download it, we'll show you how to download it. And I can just say right now, it's a lot of take-home value in there. If you ask me one last thing, I think the last sentence I got in there, Michael, and I feel very excited about this, of course. 2 months ago, I came up with what's going to be on my tombstone. And it applies a little bit here, okay? And I just figured it out. It's going to be, he couldn't sleep fast enough. Well, what do I mean? Hey, I don't want to go to bed. There's too many exciting things. I'm like a little kid out there. I don't want to go to sleep. I'm afraid I'll miss something. And I believe, and these people, you know, the persons that are listening, whomever, you pick up this book, I think you'll get excited like a little kid. I think if you're in sales, you'll really be excited. You'll take your game to the next level. But this is not only a book for sales. This is a book, I think, for virtually everyone. Yes, it's the McKay MBA of selling in the real world, but basically you could put life lessons in there, and I think it would also apply. So I'm excited, like a little kid, really elated that you gave me all this time.
Oh, my pleasure. My goodness, Harvey, it's a pleasure when you're on, and please do it again. We need an hour together. We'll drive everybody nuts.
Okay.
Good night.
You know, I'm a Viking fan, you know. I travel with them sometimes, very close to the ownership. I travel with the Gophers, and here we got you guys coming in town, boy. I'll tell you, the Badgers are coming. The Packers are coming. You'll probably hand us our head, but we will be there to fight hard, okay?
Only if you've got your credit card. Good night,
all right. Hey, thanks again. Bye-bye. Good luck.
Take care.
Sunday, Tula Dog. Yeah, it's me, the Tula Dog. For now and evermore. That's all.
A dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. So true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old. Because I want a girl to call my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Tamara Gerlach with us. She is the author of Cultivating Radiance, Five Essential Elements for Holistic Self-Care. She's taught, she's mentored, she's coached thousands of people in creating freedom and cultivating radiance in their life since 1982. Tam's brought her light, spirituality, creativity, and experience as an entrepreneur, an author, a speaker, a life and a business coach, a wife, a mother, a Buddhist, a yogi, I can't even say that word, but I'm going to get there, an athlete, a world traveler, and a free spirit to everything that she does. And she got her coach's training through the Coaches Training Institute, as well as completing the leadership training through Coactive Space. And she's assisted the leaders of numerous coaching courses, as well as 9-month leadership courses. She's passionate about working with business leaders, entrepreneurs, athletes, parents, students, and anyone who wants to empower their life. And let us say, Tamara, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you so much for having me. I'm actually so honored to be on this show and to follow Harvey McKay. Wow. He is awesome. Like, if you want to talk about radiance, like, he's our poster boy.
Oh, absolutely.
As an entrepreneur when I was 23, I learned so much from that man over the years. It's like, wow.
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure for you being here. Now, what word did I trip over? Yogini. Did I say that right?
Yogini, yeah.
Yogini.
Just a female version of a person who does yoga. So.
I never
yogis are the guys and yoginis are the girls.
Oh, good point. Now I got it. Okay, radiance. What is radiance?
What's that? It's that inner light, that brightness, that thing that we were all born with. You know, everybody has that feeling of, you know, those times when they've been really on or just really feeling like you're on purpose or well used, and it's that feeling. And I think we've all seen it too, like when you see someone walk into a room and just light it up. It's that.
Now, do we all have it and hide it, or is it something we have to create?
Yeah, well, you know, the good news is we're all born with it. So it's one of those things that, yes, we do end up, you know, over the years. Because you see little kids, they're bright, they're light, they're full of life and joy and enthusiasm. And, you know, it happens to all of us, you know, when you're a kid. They tell you things like, you know, stop daydreaming. It's like, what? Stop daydreaming? Why would you tell a kid to do that? That's like the most creative thing that they can do, you know. We're told, you know, we're not doing it right and things like that. And it starts to shut us down a little. And, you know, of course, become a teenager and then you don't fit in, you don't look right, you know, not enough, things like that. So.
Yeah, very important. Now, by the way, are you getting feedback?
A little bit. I'm sorry.
Okay, no, if you're getting feedback, yell at me and we can have them adjusted at the network, which is good. One of the things that I noticed in your press release was very important. We realize that we don't have to be young, attractive, and thin to be radiant. We're all born with radiance. All we need is a little cultivation. And I think what happens, most people, Tamara, they get lost. And they get lost in life. And they get lost in all the things that are going on. And they can't quite deal with it all. And the radiance gets held back. So realistically, what we're talking about here, and stop me if I'm wrong, It's you open a door. It's a doorway to get to who you are.
Right. That is exactly it. Yeah, it's about that knowing yourself and having that foundation that you can build upon. Because, like I said, we're born with it. We already have it, but it just gets turned down. And it's just about, you know, taking out the polish and bringing it back out and really rediscovering who we are.
Where in your life, where did that light bulb go on for you that you realized that radiance was the motivator? Radiance was that certain something that most people forget that they have or don't even know that they have, which would be the catalyst to get you where you want to be.
Yeah, well, for me personally, I, you know, had it as a child, and then, you know, I had some pretty tough things happen to me when I was between the ages of 5 and 11. I was being sexually molested, and so I learned then to shut down. I learned to not feel. I learned how to hide, and shame and fear really started to dominate. So that will really turn your light down. And then I went through a very dysfunctional marriage to an alcoholic, and that was sort of my turning point. When that relationship came to an end, it was like, yeah, I was like the least radiant person you had ever seen. I had nothing. I was broken. I was done, basically. And so there was really a rebirth. I was so broken that I had no choice but to change. And I really, I had to make a big change in myself in the way that I was always the woman who could do it all herself. I was the one who could just take care of it. And I helped other people. I didn't let other people help me. So at that point in my life, I had no choice but to get help and to reach out and reconnect. And in that process, through the teachings of other people, through many different processes, was able to rediscover what was really inside me and who I truly am. And it's so awesome. And I'm not saying, oh, I'm just an awesome person, but it's one of those things like to be able to, there's this freedom that comes with it, to be able to live in that light. It's amazing. So okay, no, I wanted to share that with people.
After listening to what you're saying, when the show's over, you got to send your ex-husband some flowers and say thank you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I absolutely appreciate, you know, he has no idea the impact he had on me. But I needed that. I really needed that low point to get me here. So I totally appreciate it.
Yeah. He may never know why you're sending him flowers, but it doesn't matter, does it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I don't actually know where he is, but that's okay.
All right, let's take it practically through. You got to hold me by the hand and take me through this now, okay? I am depressed. I just don't know where I'm going in life, and I get a hold of cultivating radiance, or you work with me personally, or I go to a workshop or something. What do you do with me? How do you get me to see it practically?
Yeah, well, I love that you just said how do you get to see it, because that's the first thing, is got to look at your beliefs. Like, how are you looking at things? What do you believe? What do you believe about yourself? What do you believe about the outside world and other people and your place in it? So we really start to look at first, like, how are people seeing things? What are their thoughts and beliefs around who they are? And that's where the shift has to happen at first, because, you know, if whatever you believe, you'll look for and you'll validate, you know, through your actions. So that's where we would start.
Okay, so I have to look around and take a look and see what I believe about, not so much other people, but what I believe about myself based on what I've gone through with other people, what I think other people have done to me, I think. So once, okay, so once I take a look at all my belief systems, what do I do at that point?
Well, there within the beliefs, actually, there are a couple of things that, you know, help. I like to help bring up people's self-esteem based on the things that come naturally to them, and I call them the radiant superpowers. And so those are the things that come just easily and naturally, and things that we most of us just take for granted that, you know, we're like, oh, yeah, everybody can do that. But it's like, no, actually, nobody has the same combination of talents and skills and experiences, and no one's put it together in the same way that we have. So we really do have special gifts. And I like to bring those back into people's lives. We usually come up with three, the top three, and those are the things that when it gets hard, when life starts to challenge us, we go, oh, wait a minute, I've got these things, and I can fall back, and they come easily. So it's so radiant superpowers are one of the things I like to work on. So we start to move the self-esteem up, and really they give another strong foundation so that when, you know, it gets a little rocky, you can say, oh, wait, I have that. And we work on attitude. Attitude is a huge, huge part of it. When I was interviewing people for the book, I just, you know, it's funny because some of the people I knew that were just radiant people, I was looking around going, okay, I want to be happy again. And I was looking around my life going, these people are happy. How are they doing it, you know? And so I started interviewing them. And then sometimes I just interview strangers. Like, I just walked up to somebody, I'm like, you're different. You're really happy. Can I talk to you?
Yeah, what's wrong with you?
They always talk to me. But one of the things that was so across the board for everyone was that they had an outrageously optimistic attitude. No matter what was going on, they were still keeping a positive spin on things. They were learning from their experiences. Things weren't, like you said, happening to them, or, you know, life wasn't against them. It was just everything was a lesson. And being able to say yes to life instead of, oh, no.
You know, Tamara, let me hold you up. Did we just? I just looked at the bell. They're throwing things at me. We're about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at and buy the book, find out about the coaching classes and the individual coaching?
Yes. Okay. CultivatingRadiance.com is where you can get my book. And we've just launched in October, and I've still got all the gifts up. So if you go and buy the book, you can come back and put your receipt in. I've got tons of gifts, things from Jack Canfield and all kinds of really fun music and all kinds of stuff. So check that out. And then you can also look at TamaraGerlach.com and get in contact with me actually on either site.
So. Wonderful. Hey, Tam, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, thank you, Michael. It was really wonderful being here.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
I got a funny feeling. We're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is
a wrap.
Dusty world. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you.